This is a No Surf Music, Burning River Fireside Chat. With guest, Ray Flanagan of Ray Flanagan and the Authorities. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com. So this is another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, and joining me today from the lovely Beachland Ballroom and Tavern on a great North Coast night is Ray Flanagan of Ray Flanagan and the Authorities. How you doing, Ray?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm pretty damn good. I'm going to see two fucking awesome Cleveland bands tonight. You are releasing your CD. And Brent Kirby and his luck is opening up for you, so I'm sure it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Indeed.
It's going to be a good one, man. For me, it's not just, even though it's, you know, CD release shows, technically whoever is putting out the record, it's like their big night, but to me, this is kind of about, like, everything that's going on. I feel like just, like, everybody's putting out records this year, and, I mean, it's... Like, so Brent just put one out, and then...
Brent just put two out, and he's got another one.
Brent just put two out. I forget that. Jack Ford.
Yeah.
And then Brent Kirby and his luck. Yep. And then so we got our new record that came out, and then Sean Brewster is going to be spinning some vinyl afterwards, and he just put out the Sean and Shelby record, and all recorded by Jim Stewart, except for the Jack Ford's record. But, yeah. So it's going to be one big celebration, and they'll be very, very loud.
Indeed. And I think there has been so much going on in the Cleveland scene. The fact that you keep rising to the top. I mean, you're one of the guys that everybody's talking about, and you really are. You know, you've earned the nickname fucking A-Ray, just because I think that is the reaction everybody has when they first hear you. Personally, I prefer the moniker Cleveland's Clapton. If I can even say that.
Are people saying that?
Diesel's saying that. I'm the only one who counts, damn it.
You know, I'm
coining it right now if I need to.
That's cool. I got one time, I will say this, if we're gonna compare me, that somebody once said Cleveland's Mike Campbell, and I'll take that.
Okay.
I like that. But,
okay.
But, no, but I if people are talking about me, I don't, it's behind my back.
Well, nobody wants to give you a big head. But I mean, certainly you've gained a reputation quite quickly because you're still extremely young as one of the go-to guitar players around, and you'll play with anybody. It's one of the things I like about you.
That's how I learn, man. That's how I learn from just being thrown into situations with playing with. It's weird. It's like the more people I play with, I feel like I steal their powers or something. You know, it's like when you play with somebody new, and it's like, what can I take from this? And it doesn't matter who it is, whether you think they're good or bad, or it doesn't matter what your opinion of it is. It's just any situation. I mean, I played plenty of blues jams where I'm in a situation that's pretty bad. Like it's pretty bad, but it's still like you learn something from that. But and also too, I think there's like an attitude of, as a guitar player, I just go in and I'm just trying not to mess anything up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to show anybody what I can do. I'm just trying not to mess anything up. So I think if your goal is just to, you know, everything that you're playing has a purpose, and then you're trying to make everything else around you sound better. I don't know. It seems to work for me, and then you just don't be an asshole. And I try not to be an asshole. I don't think, because there's assholes.
He doesn't always succeed, I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, well, I don't know what you're going to do about that. Not a whole lot you can do about that, but yeah.
So let's get a little bit of background before we get into the new album.
Okay.
So like I said, you're what, 22 now? Is 20, that right?
22, yep.
Okay. And when did you decide that this was really what you wanted to do as far as, you know, becoming a professional musician?
I've known since I was, like, about two or three, probably. I used to walk around, like one of my early birthday parties. There's always pictures of me. I had this plastic toy guitar, and there's pictures of me, like, I was real little, and I would just carry it around everywhere, like, outside, like, anywhere. And at my birthday parties, like, I remember, like, my second or third birthday party, I dressed up like, I would pretend to be Tim McGraw. I was in this, like, I just loved, you know, and I went through this whole thing. I'm kind of, in some ways, an obsessive person about certain things, and it works to my advantage and works against it, but, but I always kind of, you know, first it was Tim McGraw, and then probably, like, one of the members of NSYNC, and then Spider-Man, and then, like, I tried skateboarding.
Does Spider-Man play guitar?
No, but he was cool, though, and then, like...
None of the guys in NSYNC do, that's for damn sure.
And I also remember in first grade telling my, like, when it, in first grade, I like, that you had to fill out, like, this thing of what do you want to be when you grow up, whatever. And I told the teacher, I told her Bruce Springsteen, and she said, she was like, what? You're, like, six. But, so, I've always known. I didn't start playing until I was 11, and but really, like, when I kind of, and kind of growing up in middle-class America where I grew up, I went to Cloverleaf High School, and it's, like, kind of out in the country with, like, you just feel like you don't have a lot of options. You feel like you go to high school, and then you go to college, and you have to figure out something at college that's kind of the paradigm that, like, 90% of people are forced onto. And then, really, I got to say, when I met Brent Kirby, that was kind of the thing that pushed me to realize, like, hey, you can do this. You know, you can do this as a living. And oh, here we got a special guest visitor coming over here.
Oh, sorry, am I in the middle?
Joe Stefano's in the house on the drums. Oh, wow. You're a part of this now.
Oh, I didn't know you were in
here. I haven't seen you. It's all good.
Have a seat, man. You're in us now.
All right.
Hey, well, you remember the band. It's all good.
We got Joe Stefano here joining us.
What's up?
There we go.
So, but yeah, really when I met Brent, that's what kind of pushed me to, he pushed me, you know, to say like, listen, you can do this, don't join any cover bands. And that was kind of the thing, but, and Joe Stefano exits, yeah. But, so yeah, I might have to do some editing on this.
Whatever, it's all good. It's live music. It's a live interview.
Yeah. Live interview. But so. But yeah, and that's the thing. I just kind of realized, like, if you work at anything, you'll be able to do it. And you don't give, if you give yourself a, man, that was a sweet bike.
Yeah.
If you give yourself a backup plan, you're probably gonna fall on the backup plan.
Okay.
So.
So you just like no nets.
Yeah, that's kind of how it has to be, and I like it that way because, like, when push comes to shove, you do what you need to do to make it work. And it's not about, for me in this situation, the big realization that I had was that being a professional musician and being a musician as a living doesn't mean that you have to play at the Q and be the biggest. It just means you have to figure out a way to use these tools and these skills that you have to support yourself. And it's, in that way, it's no different than any other profession out there.
Right.
It's just that there's no real, you kind of have to invent your own place. There's no real set. Nobody gives you a piece of paper and says, oh, you did it.
Right.
You know, that's really the only difference to me.
I gotcha. Well, I think, you know, Brent and I have talked about this a lot. Mm-hmm. I think Cleveland is very unique because it has a certain set of circumstances that will allow people to make a living at it.
Yeah.
I mean, the rents are cheap here, you know, relatively. The cost of living in general is cheap, but
yeah,
there is such a vibrant scene. Can you tell me a little bit about you mentioned playing with Brent, the 10x3, and sitting in with some folks and all that. But
yeah,
how did you sort of come up on the scene, and how do you feel that you fit into it?
Okay, that's a good question. I think. Well, I've been playing in bands since I was about 13, and I played in, you know, everything from starting out in, like, metal bands to lots of different things, and I did a lot of playing when I was in high school. We did lots of, you know, type ticket sale type shows like Peabody's and The Outpost and Ken and these, those kind of things that I think young kids get roped into, and I feel like in a lot of situations, they really just are taking advantage of these kids that don't know any better. I definitely feel like that was the case in a lot of those. I mean, when you play at a place where they're like, you sell 20 tickets and you can't play, it's kind of like, that's essentially pay to play. And right. I believe that's wrong. But I was always playing, at least in my bedroom, but I was lucky enough that Garrett Tresh, who's in my band, and his brother Kyle, I've been playing with them since I've been playing. I remember, like, when Garrett bought his first bass and I showed him how to play Seven Nation Army on it. It was like, as long as either of us have been playing, we've been playing together. So I'm fortunate that I had a bass player and a drummer, Garrett and Kyle, that I could learn. We learned together. I think that was valuable to me rather than just being some bedroom guitar player, because you have to play with other people. And the thing that I find is the more people I play with, the better I get. So I playing in bands when I was younger, but really the way I started getting involved with the Cleveland scene is like, well, I started going to the jam, like Michael Bay and the Bad Boys of Blues jam nights. And that's where I feel like I really started to be able to get good at playing with other people, because part of that, me being in a kind of isolated thing down in Medina, is, you know, you think I had all these technical chops, but then I go to play Stormy Monday and I have no idea what I'm doing. So I think I really started to learn a lot about playing rhythm and accenting things and complimenting other people with those blues jams. Hello.
Popular man.
Yeah, the posting parents are here. That's when I started to. It was kind of. I felt like I got to do a lot, make a lot of my mistakes where nobody was watching. I mean, it was at blues jams in you know, Parkview and at Brothers, where there's really a no consequence situation. So I got to make a lot of my screw ups and things that I see a lot of people honestly do at shows and stuff. I got to do a lot of, like, cutting my teeth, I guess is what that is, like, mm-hmm. at those blues jams. And then I started going to the 10x3 because my focus really is songwriting. And I think that's part of why I get to play with so many people is that and Brett always says this about the way that he plays drums, but the way that I approach guitar playing is that I'm thinking like a songwriter when I play. I'm thinking of, what's the point? Like, it's a language. If you're sitting there rambling on about nothing and using words that you don't know what they mean, which a lot of times you can know all these licks, but you don't know where to put them. Mm-hmm. It's like having a vocabulary that doesn't make any sense, and you're not making cohesive sentences. So I think where I fit in is just someone that's, one, for my generation, I want to be an educator about, because I feel like I'm learning and I'm from a lot of guys that are a lot older than me, and I spend most of my time with a lot of guys that are a lot older than me and a lot more experienced than me. And in like with my band, I feel a lot of times that like I'm trying to teach them about, like, you know, rock and roll. I think it's a thing that is it's dying in a lot of ways, or maybe not dying, but what people think rock and roll is it's far away from the heart and soul of it. You know, like you have a band like, I don't, 3 Days Grace or something like that that's out there, and like, that's not rock and roll. Mm. That's an imitation of rock and roll. And like, so I don't know my place. I think I'm just someone that cares a lot and really wants to learn and also help others and learn through my own experiences about some things that I want to keep around, like folk traditions and rock and roll, and keeping those things alive and putting my own self, kind of put it with my own music, putting my own stamp on what I think that means.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this record that's coming out, I feel like, I mean, you know, by the time it's recorded and out, like, those songs are a year old to me. I feel like I'm already in a different place now, and I feel like I just am whittling down everything that I'm doing to be more focused and try and get my point across. So I don't know if that quite answers the question, but it's hard to say what I think my place is. I don't
know. No, you did a good job. You did a good job. I think you brought up an interesting point there, too. I mean, the reason why I personally think that Cleveland's Clapton thing works so well is because you are unique on the scene, I think, because you do play pure rock and roll. And there are very few people out there who do that anymore. It almost seems like a throwback to the classic rock days mm-hmm. when, you know, you kind of wonder why that is, you know, why rock sure. is gone. But you also were talking about some folk roots, too.
Yeah. And what I think about that, too, is I was actually talking with Kevin Johnson, who's Brent Kirby and his Lux bass player. Mm-hmm. We had this great conversation, and we were kind of talking. He was talking. He asked me the question, what do you hate? Like, what bands do you hate? And it was just an interesting thing. He's like, I don't care what you like. Like, what do you hate? So I said, whatever. I hate Poison. That's my least favorite band of all time. But what I asked Kevin, and what he said was one of the most profound things I've ever heard. And he said, I hate anything. I'm starting to hate anything that's not rooted in some kind of tradition. Mm. And I think that that's like, it's so true when you really break what makes great music great. Like, I always, like, an example, like something like Radiohead, which is like an oddball band. That seems like it's just this tripped out thing. But why it's so effective is those guys learned a lot of music. It's coming, it doesn't come from nowhere. You know, like somebody could just make a bunch of electronic stuff and write some odd songs with some kind of cryptic lyrics and a lot of people do that, and it doesn't really have the depth. I think depth in music comes from tradition and learned tradition. It's like I grew up on Springsteen, mm-hmm. and but from Springsteen you go back to Dylan, and from Dylan you go back to Woody Guthrie, mm-hmm. and then you kind of have to go in retrograde to learn these things. What was the question again?
I guess the relationship between the rock roots and the folk roots.
Okay. Sorry. There's lots of people walking around. So the relationship, it's kind of the same thing in the way that, like, rock, you trace it back. Like, in that same way, I could go from, like the Stones were copying Muddy Waters, and then mm-hmm. Aerosmith copied the Stones, and then Motley Crue copied Aerosmith, and by the time that happens, it's so out of control. I think tracing things back to their source is where you find the real power in right. music, to me. It's where, like, when the farther back you can trace it and then draw on it, and then you put your own spin on it. You don't have to play like Chuck Berry to play rock and roll, you know, but I think you have to know those things in order mm-hmm. to play rock and roll. It's kind of like anything. If you're going to be a doctor, you need to know about what you doing. You need to know the history of it, and you need to know the purpose of it. I think that kind of reverse timeline thing gives everything a sense of purpose.
Right.
So
right.
So in that way, I folk is more of like a mindset to me more than genre when I'm the way that I'm thinking of it. Taking old things and twisting them into new things is kind of where I'm coming from with that.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, when you get right down to it, it's interesting because you described essentially my musical journey right there. As I was a classic rock guy growing sure. up in Cleveland, so Springsteen was my boy, and
yeah.
through him and others in the Heartland rock, I got into Dylan and those guys,
yeah.
and then through Dylan discovered Woody, and through Woody, you know, went back to the Carter, you know.
Right.
But like, when you get right down to it, what is Heartland rock? What is Springsteen? Except, you know, it's folk with a bunch of electric instruments,
right? But it's modernized, and you know it's what it is. It's a reflection of that time period, mm-hmm. which is it has to be that way. You can't just be throwback, and you know it has to be a reflection of the time period. But drawing on that and getting to the source of that is really where you find where it makes sense,
right?
And to the because the farther back you go, the farther back it'll be like. You know, when you talk about somebody like Woody Guthrie, you go back to the Carter Family, or even before that, before we have recorded music,
mm-hmm.
the farther back you go, the more you have music that was being made out of necessity. No, nobody was thinking about, like, songcraft and good songwriting, and charts didn't exist, and things like this, where, you know, when you can get to the I think the reason it has power originally is because somebody like Blind Willie Johnson is playing blues out of necessity to, you know, it needs to get out of him because he's the one that's going through these hard times. And I think someone like you know, like Dylan, I don't necessarily think he was going through hard times, but he was able to channel the music that was made out of necessity and then bring that in an effective way to the masses. I think that's, to me, where that comes from.
Okay, fair enough. If that's the case, then what's the necessity for you? What are you trying to portray about the modern world in your music?
For me, like, I can only, it's a reflection of my life, but I think my life is a lot of people's lives, because I grew up in, it's not like I had a bad life. I grew up in middle-class America. It's that thing I'm going to kind of reiterate myself here about, like, you grow up and a lot of people don't, they have to meet somebody else in order to break their paradigm. Because if you're in a box where you're told what you have to do and these are your only options, then that's all you know. And some people are fortunate enough to break out of that on their own, that you don't just have to go to college and stuff like that. But for me, my place is, the purpose of it is to say that, like, to make people really think about things, really think about your ideals, really think about, like, what you think about the world. Like, it's not, don't be apathetic, I guess, is the thing. Like, if you think something needs to change, you need to change it. And I think rock and roll, whether I'm writing, like, political songs or anything like that, it's always been a symbol of that kind of freedom, you know. And I feel like I express a lot of, like, it's about relating to people, but the necessity comes from just that, the frustrations of just being a normal American person, because you could probably line up 200 people and, like, you ask, like, are you really, really happy? Like, in general, people are like, they're fine. But it's like, it's a hard thing to balance. I think that's the power of Springsteen to me, of this, like, balancing, like, what is the American dream? Like, what is that? And I think that's something that everybody struggles with, because it's kind of a preconceived notion there that, like, there is even an American dream, and you have to be, like, what is my American dream? That's kind of, I think that's a necessary thing, because you're just dealing with the daily struggles of what you have to go through to survive and make a living.
Right, right. Well, I think that actually transitions nicely into talking about the new album, which I am holding in my hand at the moment.
Sure, a lot of angry work songs on it.
Well, yeah, it's called A Hard Shell to Break.
Yeah.
But the second track, I'm Just Trying to Live, that's basically what you were talking about in that track, right?
Yeah.
You know, what you're doing with your life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's an interesting... That track, I think, is like...
Yeah, somebody had a heart attack.
Yeah.
That was the good folks at Cleveland EMS.
There they are. To me, that tune... at first, I was kind of skeptical about that tune, because it's not very, like, it's not like there's clever lyrics in it, or it's not really, like, it's just very, it's pretty much me just saying exactly what I think. It's like, I would say the same thing in conversation as the lyrics are, you know. It's very just, like, me kind of talking of, like, leave me alone. Say, what I think about when I think of that song is being at my graduation party, and, like, you know, a graduation party, just also known as an awkward party.
Everybody's, you know, asking you what you're doing with your
life.
What
are you doing? Where are you going to school? They'll just come up to you and, where are you going to school?
Right.
That always just, like, fucked with me. I was always like, what? Like, how dare, like, why? What? Why does it, where are you going to school? Not even, are you going to school? What are you thinking about doing?
Right.
And it's, but the thing is, like, you have, at a graduation party, there's, like, you might be, like, 200 people there, and, like, 100 of those people are people that you have never met, or people that you haven't seen since you were, like, 2 years old, that
right.
just show up and give you a card full of money and say, and they want to ask you that question. So you have to deal with that question, like, 100 times in a day. And after a point, it was just like, just fucking stop asking me. Like, it's none of your business. And because, and the reason that I have that reaction to it is because the first few times that it happens, when you're, like, saying, I want to be a musician, I'm going to play music, they just give you this, it's just, they immediately become condescending, most people. And So that's where that song comes from, is just like having a feeling that you have a calling,
mm-hmm.
and everybody wanting to question it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no more questions.
Well, I think that really speaks to the personality of an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just something different about somebody who does, like, I mean, it's that necessity you were talking about. Like, you can't be anything else but a musician.
Yeah.
You know, you may take other jobs because you need money here and there or whatever, but you're always going to be a musician. I can't be anything but a writer.
Yeah.
You know, I've tried, believe me. I've worked plenty of 9-to-5s and midnight to nines and all sorts of shit. And yeah,
it's hard, man.
Well, I mean, it's hard when you have something else that you need to do.
Yeah.
And like you say, like, the vast majority of people, I think, they're trying to live this, the quote unquote American dream of, you know, I go to college, I get a good job,
right.
I have a family, I buy a house in the suburbs, I have 2.3 kids or whatever the average is now, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, for other people, and I think this is what you were trying to say in that. That's not the material stuff, the perfect life kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's not important. And you just need to do what you need to do. And you don't want people, you know, judging you on that, because it's what you need to do, not what they need to do.
Right. And that's the thing too, is it, I think some people that do have that whole go to college thing. There's some people that like really want to be a doctor, really want to be a zoologist.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, like, go to college. But go to college and fucking work while you're there. Don't go there. Like, you know, I feel like every day is like, it's a new day of me being a student of this, the art and craft and the history of music. And I feel like a lot of kids, they go to college because they see a list of, oh, I can make $120,000 a year doing that. And then they go there. And then they end up changing their major 4 times, because as soon as that wall of like, oh, the point where you actually have to do work, they realize that it's really, they're not passionate about it. I don't know. I think a lot of people that go to college and have that thing is not really, but I think they really believe that it's their dream, that it's what they're supposed to do, because
right.
it's just what they've been told, and they've never met anybody or never been. They live in a box, and they never had that thing that pulled them out of, that made them question it. They never question it, I think.
Right. Well, and I think that even goes back to what you were saying before about rock and roll just being that thing that's there.
Yeah.
That, you know, you might not necessarily be singing a political song.
Right.
But you're standing up on that stage and saying, hey, things can be different.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles going up there and singing, like, Hold My Hand or something is like, people went apeshit over that, because it's just like, and that has to, like, to do with the music side of things. That's just the sound of rock and roll. The things that, like, it's simple, and it's just like, that's the point. That's the thing that I can't really explain, the way that lots of sweet bikes rolling through here.
Indeed,
right,
it's a nice day. Everybody's taking advantage.
But the musical side of things, where the music itself, the sound of music, is moving in that way, but it, you know, but rock and roll has always been that. It's sort of the any good art is that. It's the escape from, like, the sort of mundane things.
Right.
It's a fantasy.
Right.
You know,
it's a minor rebellion on a Saturday night before you have to go back
right.
to work. Something like that.
Yeah, you can curse your boss all you want, and Monday goes back.
Indeed,
but,
indeed. All right. Well, let's talk about a couple more of the songs,
okay.
if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Let's go with the third one, because honestly, I feel that is not just the best track in this album, but the best I've ever heard you do.
It's Just Rain?
It's Just Rain, exactly.
Cool.
It's a really interesting song, because in many ways it is, you know, sort of like you were saying, it's not really about much. It's about, you know, rain and
it's
religion.
About a simple thing, but
right.
I think it speaks for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of like 3 separate little stories in there.
Right.
Really, that tune, I had the... It's funny, like, I think part of, like, songwriting, like, I think the good songs, like, a lot of times, like, I just write what I'm feeling, and then I try and make it make sense. And It's Just Rain came to me, Like, I just had that. I had that chorus, basically. Okay. And I was like, what does this mean? It's basically how I ended up writing that song. It's like, I had it, and it came. I was there, and I was like, I really like that. But I was like, what does it mean? And so it's just a metaphor of, like a metaphor first of, like the first one's, the first verse is just about, it's like, it's a simple, that like a child that's scared of a thunderstorm. And then he kind of goes into talking about how his dad told him, like, that not to be scared of the thunderstorm. But his dad, he also kind of goes into how his dad was, like, pretty, like, maybe one of those people that just kind of accepted the, you know, like it says, my father wasn't one to talk semantics. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, he doesn't, for me, like, it's kind of like, he doesn't want to talk about what things mean. You just accept what you've been told, and then that's your life.
Right. I think there's a lot in there, in just those few lines, about kind of what we were just talking about relating to the past generations and maybe breaking molds of of what people have always done and thought of, and, you know, finding your own way to do things.
Yeah. So. But that tune, it just seems to resonate with people because it's packaged. It's simple. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's the ultimate goal is, like, how can you say the most with actually saying the least? Like, how can you get your point across with saying the least? And
it's a very Zen thing.
It is, but I think but It's Just Rain. It's just kind of like, I think it's about really how, like, people worry too much.
Right.
You know, and, like, for me, like, the second verse is pretty, I mean, the second verse is pretty autobiographical about, like, this day when I was on lunch break at this warehouse that I was working at.
Mm-hmm.
And normally on lunch break, you either go sit in the break room or you just go drive to Taco Bell or something, and then you come back. But it's like, this day I was just like, I'm just going to go for a walk and see how far I can walk in an hour and come back. And because I just, it was just, you were having a, like you were saying, to have a 9-to-5 when you know that there's something else that you were supposed to be doing, after a while it just wears down on you. And I was just having one of those days where I was just so sick of being in there, and I just went for a walk. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, like, you know, sometimes taking a walk really does clear your head, thinking about, like, what are you getting so upset about this? What are you getting so upset about this warehouse job? If you don't want to work in this job, then don't do it and find something else to do. But whatever it is, you've got to put the work in. You know, the more that the trade-off is, like, you could suck dick and work in a 9-to-5 job and just do whatever somebody tells you to do, and it's an easy, I mean, you don't have, you know, it's clear cut what you're supposed to do, and then they'll hand you your $10 an hour paycheck at the end of 2 weeks. But when there's something, the trade-off is to doing what it is that you think you're supposed to be doing or what you want to do is, you really have to do a lot more work. Yeah. I think a lot more, not necessarily more work, but more figuring out, you know, how, the how of it is harder. But that, yeah, that tune in general, though, like, so you could break down each verse and I could go through, like, and analyze it, like, in a literary way, but really, like, then the point of the song is that it's all comes together with It's Just Rain. Because I was actually on that walk, I did get rained on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where it came from. I was I was walking and it started raining. I was like, just rain, like, you know, it's a simple tune, but I think the message resonates effectively with that phrase. Yeah, like, those are the phrases that you, like, you hope you could turn into a song all the time, to me. But
well, and then by the time you get to the section about the clerk, that's the that's the highlight to me. And you, what's the line she says?
She says, "You poor thing, you're soaked." And I said, honey, that ain't the worst thing that I've been. Exactly. I think that's kind of a funny line, but it, you know.
Well, it goes directly to the point you were just making, too, which is, you know, people worry so much about things that don't matter in the end. Okay, I'm wet.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, so I'm wet. Like, I'll dry out later. It's all good. And that, you know, I found that that to be really telling in a lot of ways.
Sure, yeah, thanks. Yeah, because it's fun, like, you know, that image of, like, being so pissed off and, like, just walking away from this warehouse for a minute. And then it starts to rain. You're like, God damn it, it's fucking raining now on top. And then you're just like, you know what? Like, I'm making myself upset.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. That's that song kind of in a nutshell.
Fair enough, fair enough. Let's step back a couple and go to Decider, because that's the leadoff track. And
yeah.
In a lot of ways, it's one of the most rocking tracks.
It's very heavy.
It is. And it, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a frightening one. It's like, oh my God, Ray has turned into some kind of crazy god.
Yeah.
Can you tell us where that one came from?
That tune, I'm trying to think. That's one of those tunes where, like, I couldn't really tell you specifically where it came from, but I know what it makes me feel, and it's just like, well, I just started writing this tune. I always had this fucking, I don't know if it's from being raised religious and then revolting against it, but I always had this line in my head, and even though I've written this song already, it's this kind of sounds making me sound like a crazy person, but I have this line of like, of just the I am a demon thing. I think that line can be interpreted in so many ways. Like certain people, like, you know, relationships that you're in where they, you know, the significant other make you feel like a nuisance after a while, make you feel like it's kind of about just relationships gone awry, but like, and also about people that, it's really what it's about, man. It's kind of chaotic the way that I approach it in the song. I think it, like in the chorus, old ends. I'm not trying to think of the lyrics. Lots of car noise. Can't make up your mind. It's really just about like just chaotic relationships and just how a lot of relationships end and the frustrations you get in with other people. That's really just it's a dumb girl song at its heart, but it sounds like Black Sabbath. So that's kind of what that tune is.
Fair enough. Well, and it seems to be, you know, about you having some control too over, you know, that chaotic situation.
That's a sketchy thing to talk about, because if you say you want control, it sounds like you're trying to be a controlling person, but it was really like, and I think that is about just like, well, that whole part of like wanted to steal her, but I couldn't hide her thing of like just wanting somebody that you can't have for one reason or another, whether they're in a relationship already or whatever. And then being frustrated that there's nothing you can do about it. I think that, so yeah, there's an element of that, control thing.
Fair enough. So just taking a step back then and mm-hmm. talking about the album and your style more broadly.
Okay.
And this is your second release with the Authorities. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I feel like your style is very much a throwback to something that we don't see very often mm-hmm. anymore. It's just pure rock. How did you settle on that style, and what made you decide that this was the kind of music that you wanted to make?
I don't feel like I'm making a conscious decision to do it. I think it's just a lot of what I love and listen to is stuff like, I mean, I love like AC/DC, and then like I also love, but I love like Springsteen and Tom Petty. And Neil Young is a hero of mine too. I love people that, like, there's something about, like, somebody that rocks, like, a single, I'm coming from, like, somebody's singular, I've never been that much into bands where there's, like, a lot of different songwriters. I always like to hear one person's, even, like, and it's evident in our own music, there's not, like, a ton of harmonies, except for where they're needed,
because
I always, For what I like to do, I always feel like there's a power in one voice, and if you add a lot of times, I feel like music that has a lot of harmony, then the power comes more from the sound than about like what's actually being said. It's really just everything that I do is just a reflection of what I listen to. I think I feel like an old soul in some ways. I feel out of touch with my own generation sometimes, but what I'm trying to do is navigate my way to creating something that brings those elements of those things that I don't want to get lost about the old music that I love,
right?
But also make it in a way that it's understandable by somebody that's 22 years old in 2015. It's not something that I don't think I'm really choosing to do. That's just how I write. I'm not someone that could probably go to Nashville or something and be like a genre writer for things. Maybe I could, in theory,
do that. But why would you want to?
Yeah, why would I want to? I could, in theory, do that, but it's just, this is just the stuff that comes out of me because it's what I listen to and it's what I know. It goes back to that thing of like being rooted in a tradition. Mm-hmm. This is what I know about. So this is what I do. You don't listen to Ozzy Osbourne and then go write a jazz album. You know, like there's a reason I'm not making a jazz album, and it's not a decision. It's because I can't play it. You know, I don't know anything about it. So it's really just because that's what I know about.
I gotcha.
You know,
I gotcha. Well, on the topic of the power of one voice and sort of getting into tradition, mm-hmm. You decided to close the album on a much lighter note than with the rest. That was Year After Year, the seventh and final track, which is pretty much, I mean, you and an acoustic guitar.
One microphone, me and acoustic guitar, yeah.
Indeed. So why did you decide to go that route, and especially on an album that otherwise is, you know,
in your
falls
face.
Out, exactly.
There's a few reasons. One, I had written that song. I wrote that song on my birthday last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a song about that growing up, and like I like that. I think there's a cool line in there about still waiting for real life to kick in year after year. Like what, like it starts when you want it to start. But that song goes along too with that being a more recently written song, where actually these tunes, I maybe shouldn't even say this, but these tunes, we played all of the other tunes at our CD release party last year.
Mm-hmm.
We had them. It just sometimes it takes a minute because of money or whatever to go get around to recording them.
Mm-hmm.
So Year After Year, I put it at the end because it marks sort of a transition to me. I don't know what the next thing I'll do is, but I thought it was like all these other tunes we had, and we were really tight and knew them really well. They've been around, and they were snapshots of like maybe a year ago, and this one kind of kept it current this January for me. I wrote that song and I really liked it, but that song kind of came by itself. Like it wasn't like it was like the one song I wrote during that like month or two period. Like it wasn't like a very productive time as far as writing goes for me. And it stood alone. And I thought that if I didn't put it on here, like a year from now, when I do the next thing or whatever, I wouldn't care about it anymore. It was one of those things where it was fresh and I had to get it out. But I also thought it tied in. I thought it was good because the whole album kind of is like relentless, punch you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought that was a good, it like makes you think there's going to be a sequel in a way. But it also, I will say this, that one of the ways that I justified it to the bandmates, because they were kind of, some of them were kind of like unsure at first. They were like, oh, that's cool. You got a nice little girly song on there. There's a Pantera album called Far Beyond Driven, and the whole thing is just like it punches you in the face. It's like my favorite metal album.
Okay.
I know you're not a metal guy, but I love this record. And then at the end of the record, they do a cover of Planet Caravan, this Black Sabbath song, and it's just this like smoke weed, like chilled out jam.
Okay.
So there's an element of that too, but really it's more about that song needed to come out, and I needed to do something with it, and it just the timing was right for it to be on there. I don't know.
Yeah, it's fair enough, man. You gotta go with your vision.
Yeah.
Sure. So, on the subject of Year After Year, I know you just said you don't really know what you're gonna do next, and that's perfectly fair, but
I do in a way, but
okay, well, then you can answer the question however you like, but so what do you see, you know, for the future of not only the band and your musical career, but also the Cleveland music scene in general, and what's going on here?
I think that one of two things could happen, in my opinion, and that's like what I hope doesn't happen is that like 5 years down the road, everything, all the great things that are going on right now kind of fizzle out. I don't see that. The more that we get the communities involved, like lots of these festivals that come out, like Bright Winter and stuff like that, and there's all these local breweries and local coffee places and local clothing companies and things, the more that we have these individual, more like independent people that are trying to, the more we all support each other as a community in that way, like get together and have work in conjunction, those things are going to stay thriving. And I think people, it seems like in Cleveland, people are, they would rather go to a place like that. They'd rather buy like local things that people made than go to Walmart. It seems like people are starting to get a little bit fed up with that.
Well, and honestly, not to jump on top of you, but I feel that's always been an important part of Cleveland to me, because everything here has always been about the working class. You know, and I think people realize that. Like when I was born, there were 11 working steel mills.
Yeah.
And by the time I was your age, there were none.
Yeah.
You know, now we've got a few of them back. But, you know, just seeing what can happen to an economy when you make everything about, you know, the few people at the top who are making things and making all the money.
Yeah.
I think there is an understanding here that there not isn't necessarily in other places that, you know, even something as quirky as music, you know, it's good to support the locals in some ways.
Yeah, and I think with all, especially all these bands around, like, there's so many, I mean, between, like, the, and there's, they're all in kind of separate cliques. Like, I mean, I know you're in with, like, the Womacks, and then you have people like Welshie Arms that are doing something totally different, but are gaining a lot of attention. I mean, they sold out the House of Blues for their yearly show, and, there's just lots of great bands, like Midnight Passenger, the stuff that Brent Kirby does. It's like, eventually, my hope is, and what I feel is going to happen is, eventually, Cleveland's just going to make so much noise with everything that's going on, not just the music, because I mean we're getting noticed for lots of other things too. Like we have all these museums and we have all these great restaurants and all this stuff that we're getting noticed for too. Eventually, it's going to make so much you can't ignore it anymore. After a point, it's like people, it's like, okay, what's going on in Cleveland? And I think that's starting to happen.
Right.
And then it's kind of a thing where, like, whether people come check it out and then they decide to stay or not. But I think there's going to be, there's got to me, I think there's some band or somebody that has got to, like, lead all of it in some ways. Like, maybe, like, what I mean by that is, like, somebody's going to get some kind of national attention,
right?
And then they're going to come here and be like, what else is going on?
Right.
I could see that happening. I think we have a strong enough scene here between all the different artists for it to be like that, for it to be like a Seattle in the early 90s, where like there's just all of this pool of this talent that's spread through a few different artists. I could definitely, to me, that's my hope. I'm not going to sit here and predict what's going to happen, but
right.
That's where I see it in my head.
Well, I think even we had a little bit of that with the Black Keys. You know, they hit it big, and, you know, they've, Dan especially is, you know, stuck around and it's produced, Jessica Lee Mayfield and a bunch of other locals.
All kinds of stuff.
Exactly. And I think, you know, if we have a few more that really get out there and sort of, you know, make a name for Cleveland on the national scene, the way that, like you said, you know, Seattle was in the 90s or something.
Yeah.
You know, it really is a vibrant culture, and I've been all over the country, and you don't see music cultures like this.
And you know what I think, too, though? It really is regional. Like, Cleveland really has its own, just, it's more of a feel, man. Like, there's a grittiness that runs through any genre of Cleveland music that is just, it's Cleveland. You know, just in the same way there's like Texas blues and what, like, there's a Cleveland thing, and it's, you can't quite put your finger on it, but it's a Cleveland thing. I don't think a lot of Cleveland artists get out of town enough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're around spreading the gospel of like what we have going on here. I think it kind of remains, it's almost like we're Delta blues people or something, where we stay in Cleveland and we play our music in Cleveland.
Right.
And I want to figure out a way, but it'd be like with me, like I've got a bunch of guys in my band that are in college and stuff, and like we're not in a position right now where we can really like go out and tour, and the level of commitment isn't quite there.
Right.
And I think that's a lot of the times the case. You get the right group of guys to make the chemistry in the band work, but then the catch-22 is that you can't, they're not all guys that are available to go tour. As like, you know, it's, But I think that's a Cleveland thing where I think a lot of bands don't even believe that they're capable of doing that. They kind of there's a shoot yourself in the foot thing that happens here sometimes.
Well, I think that's also part of the downside of having a community where you can survive.
Yeah.
Just playing here,
you feel comfortable,
right? I mean, we're listening to Brent right now through the door here. I mean, that man is the hardest working musician in Cleveland.
Absolutely, and one of my favorite songwriters. Period, man. I hold him like in this like. Well, I'll take Brent, to me personally, I know I would catch some flack for this, I'll take Brent Kirby over Ryan Adams any day of the week. But.
I'll take almost anybody over Ryan Adams at this point.
But you know what I mean, though.
I do.
You know, it's like, he's a guy that is just heralded. And he's great, he's got some great tunes, but like...
But they were all 20 years ago.
And it's just also like, you sit to wonder, like, you have to, when you sit there and you put someone like that, who
right.
I think Brent is every bit as talented, and
oh, yeah.
to me, I...
I can name at least a dozen people in the Cleveland scene who are
a lot of them, man.
There, and I mean
who are up there that should be just not that I'm trying to pinpoint him, but it's just like they should have the quality of their work is good enough to garner that same attention,
right?
And recognition.
Indeed. Well, I think the problem is the way the music industry has gone. There's so little room at the top, and it's all. Honestly, it's all the lowest common denominator where you're going to make money. You know,
yeah.
I mean. The 15-year-old girls are the ones who are still buying albums, so Taylor Swift will always be a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're finding ways to survive, as we said, in this new market and do things all on our own.
Yeah.
But it's still, you know, it's going to take a while before we really figure things out.
Yeah.
So like I said, Brent is already on stage, and I
yep.
know you want to catch him, and
I do
want to
go
do.
Watch him, and it's raining.
And it's raining.
It's just rain.
It is just rain.
It's going to end in a better way.
I mind it a lot less than my computer probably does, so
we
ought to get out of here before it gets too wet. But fucking A, Ray Flanagan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for
having me. It was terrific to talk to you, and the band is Ray Flanagan, The Authorities. The new album, which I am holding right here in my hand. Is what the hell is it? It's a
hard
shell to
break.
you printed it on there so hard to see. I can't
even
read
it. It's a hard shell to read.
Indeed, but it was great to talk to you. And if you guys get a chance, and you're looking for some real old school quality rock and roll. Ray Flanagan is the man to talk to. So thanks again for joining us. We're gonna go in and rock.
All right.
This has been another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, signing off.
This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.